The most difficult aspect about art is to understand that the image has been transformed. In art, the most difficult thing to understand is that you're dealing not with the imagination but creativity, which is different. Creativity is different from imagination. The old saying that the mystic swims in the ocean that the psychotic drowns in is very true. Creativity is able to compose an image base, but imagination can only deliver the image base and usually have it arranged on natural structures. Natural in this sense of being almost inevitable. In imagination, the images come to you and play you. You're the instrument. So that one has to distinguish between imagination and another function which is very similar to it, but which should be designated more properly as creative imagination. Creative imagination. Or creativeness, or creativity. And the operative mode of creativity is that there's an undercurrent of memory happening. So that in creative imagination, there's a mnemonic component which is not there in the mythic imaginative sense. And it makes all the difference in the world. The difference is that in imagination, the referent of the image base is always nature. So much so that a negative image base is accurately of a distorted nature. So that, for instance, if you're in a therapeutic situation, helping someone, or even helping yourself, you can very accurately, through the distortion of the image base, trace back and find out what the distortion in the natural comportment is. And that distortion in the natural comportment will always register in the ritual level. So that the key to restoring someone to health is to change the way they do things. It's like the fundamental fulcrum. If you don't change the way you do things, you cannot bring your image base in consonance with the real nature, the actual nature. The distorted image base, because it is more powerful than nature, through its manipulative effect distorts one's comportment to nature and it registers in the ritual. But if you try a therapy which is based on imagination for someone who is in a particular conscious turmoil, the therapy will be ineffective. If there's any cure at all, it'll be incidental. It's like in most psychotherapies, the cure rate is exactly 50%. It's the same rate as if you didn't do anything at all. Because you cannot work on the mythic level, on the imaginative level, with knots in consciousness, because the knots in consciousness have a much stronger organizing capacity than the kind of level at which therapy is being applied. And so it's tantamount to telling somebody good advice, and they know it's good advice, but they can't follow it. They don't follow it. In fact, they do not follow it. So that creative imagination is quite distinct from imagination, and it always has a mnemonic undertow to it, so that memory is always functioning. The referent for memory is the deep self. The deep self. One little experiment that you can work with yourself. If you try to memorize an arrangement of material just on a one-to-one basis, you'll have a certain curve which will plateau out very quickly of success. But if you use a sense of self-presence and compose the way you're seeing, impose an arrangement, the curve goes indefinitely higher, and you have an increasing success rate. In other words, the capacity for memory is indefinite. It doesn't matter how many objects you're dealing with or how much you're dealing with. Memory, because it has the deep self as its referent, has an infinite capacity. But by just reacting to materials without a sense of self-presence and without a compositional design on it, you reach a plateau very quickly of a limitation. And most education that is given to people today works on this very primitive level. And we think that we're doing great things by teaching kids to be imaginative. And so we want them to watch TV, and we want them to watch this, that, and the other thing. And what they are doing is that they are inculcating a very truncated capacity. So that art is quite distinctly different from ritual. Art is creative imagination, not just imagination. Or if you like to make the distinction, art is creativity, and not just imagining. And the thrust, the import of these kinds of statements is that in a very definite sense, the productions of the activity of art are real. They're very real. Whereas the productions of imagination, it's always problematical whether they are real or not. So that there is a distinct difference. So that when we work with our art, our various art projects, these four art projects that we have are meant to give us faceted insights into the nature of this distinction. Now, one of the most important aspects here in distinguishing between imagination and creativity is in the sculpture project and assignment that you have. It's quite possible that the sculpture that you make will be made on the basis of imagination. Not all of us are capable of artistic activity first time out. And most certainly not all of us are able to distinguish between imaginative activity and artistic activity. We don't have the sensitivity yet for it. But now we're developing it. So that while the sculpture that you make may well have been made on the basis of imagination, by having to redo someone else's sculpture, you cannot bring imagination into play. You have to bring creativity into play. You're forced to do the other activity. And by doing the other activity, by doing creativity rather than imagination, in a very grand strategic way, you have to even subconsciously, shift your base of working from nature to the deep self. This is why the old saw is, you have not learned anything for real until you can teach it to somebody else. So the ancient technique was not to rely on the fact, did you understand the teacher, but can you now become a teacher in your own right? Because by having to teach it, you have to work on the basis of creativity. You have to work with your own sense of presence, your own sense of composition. You have to cue in the deep self. You can't just take a rote, imaginative shortcut. Now you have to really, you have to work at it. You have to bring yourself into play. Notice here that the person becomes the real fulcrum in the artistic activity. When artistic activity does in fact occur, when the creative process does in fact flow, that is the field wherein the person can be established. And one of the indications that a human being has really come into their own is they have their own distinct style of creativity. For instance, one can look at a painting by Matisse, and there's no way that Picasso made that painting. That distinctiveness of the personal mode is an index to the actuality of the creativity. The self-presence from the deep self, and also that quality of composition, will always be distinctive. So that if you have a therapy that works on the imaginative faculty of man, as we said before, the so-called cure rate is about 50%. It's a toss-up, and usually it's because of extraneous qualities that anything happens at all. But if you work with creative imagination, the success rate is approaching 100%. The only time that it would not work is if someone did not follow it through, did not in fact do it. If you do it, it works all the time. Works 100% of the time. So that this beautiful phrase that was popularized 20 years ago by Virginia Satir popularized the phrase people making. And people making is an essential human function. And the basic quality of reality for us is that we are able to recognize that we can make ourselves. Another book by the great archaeological popularizer Gordon Child, Man Makes Himself. The distinctive function of a human being is that they can create themselves. Now the popular phrase misses the techne and the actual mechanics and the depth and the precision of it, but the popular phrase is that you have to learn to be yourself. Or someone says colloquially, I want to be myself, I want to be who I am. This is a very accurate phrase, but to do that requires, and the Greek word for it was techne. Techne. You have to know how to do it. And the key to that is to shift your base of operation so that your referent is no longer nature, but is the deep self. And the only way that that can happen is through a transformation. Through a transformation. So we have, I have a series of slides here of several artists in the 20th century, most of them in the beginning here of Henry Moore, because these artists give us, they're like examples for us, they're models for us we don't have to be as good as Henry Moore. That's not the point. That's not the issue. But here are human beings in our own time who have been able graphically to do what we need to do. And they've done it in large. That is to say, they've done it against a worldwide scope. One of the great things about a major artist is they are able to be public in terms of the whole world in the 20th century. It's a very, very difficult thing to be. Now, this is Henry Moore, and the first slides are of Moore. I thought you'd just like to see. He lived to be 88, I believe. His favorite phrase was that Michelangelo was heard to be carving the night before he died at age 89. And he wanted to do just that. He said Titian lived to be 101 and never lost his artistic quality. There is absolutely no decline in creative activity once you have achieved that human independence. There's no decline whatsoever. Whereas if you have lived only on the basis of an imagination, there's a marked decline that sets in. In fact, senility is an index to the fact that you have not matured at all as a person, no matter how, quote, successful you have been on the outside. I should take it one step further and give the old traditional hermetic religious phrase, even death does not diminish the capacity for creative imagination. I've got a series of four or five slides to just quintessentially present the artistic process. First, we saw the man who was himself. He's there in himself. Now, it may not show, but if you have an eye for it, you can see that Moore is together, as we used to say. Here he is in northern Italy. This is in the mountains outside of Carrara, where all the great marble has been quarried since the Renaissance. And there's the artist sitting with the materials in raw. He's got his materials in front of him, and he's not sitting this out, but he's sitting in with the material. He's sitting in with nature. That marble is in nature, but has been extracted from nature in those blocks. And those blocks now are, I'm going to use a phrase which you're somewhat familiar with, and yet give it a little twist, a little attenuation now. He's sitting with blank mythic images. Each of those blocks is a blank mythic image. It's like a little cartoon where nothing has been drawn. So that the artist is able to work with a whole array of yet unexpressed, unknown mythic images, and it doesn't bother him. Now, for someone who is, as the Greeks used to say, a barbarian, being confronted by blank mythic images is a terrifying process. And the only response that natural man had to that kind of a condition was to be afraid. What? Oh, shit, what am I going to do? See, like that. For the artist, what was once the source of terror becomes the material out of which he works. The unknown becomes, for the artist, his fodder. He survives. He thrives on the unknown. He's glad to be sitting there facing these several hundred blocks. But what he's looking for the block. He's looking for the blank block. Why? Because he's looking with the inner eye. The deep self is looking with the inner eye. And so in this slide, you find the artist going to size up the material. And you can see him standing there with his great sledgehammer next to him. He always wore characteristically either blue or dark black with a gray stripe in it. His clothes always ran to those colors. He was raised in a working class mining town in the Midlands of England, and he never lost his sense of that's where he belongs. He's a bulldog from the mining town, and he always had that kind of personality. I had a very elegant friend who from the Cheviot Hills area, Natalie Kroll Solomon, who did a number of sculptures around town. She did the great fountain and brickwork for the Great Western Savings at the corner of Olympic and La Cienega. Natalie's a very tall, elegant, beautiful international woman. She went to visit Henry Moore at his studios at Much Haddam in England. And she was there for about a day, and looking around and taking in the man. She broke down in tears at about 4 p.m. and he had to call a cab for her. It was just too much. The legitimacy of the man and his work was so overwhelming that the beautiful Beverly Hills socialite had understood that she had met more reality in one day than she had in the whole previous life, 35 years of her previous life. It's that quality that the artist is able to exude himself, but to exude himself not just in a general radiation, but to channel, I use that word, channel and focus that radiation onto a single point. That's the penetration of his insight. And very often in the Renaissance, the late Renaissance and Renaissance cosmography, you would see this illustrated by the third eye projecting out a beam of light. That's like the degenerate comic strip version of presenting what somebody like Michelangelo did in just one glance. It may have taken him months to do something, but Michelangelo could compose in a single glance. Later on in the 20th century, the great Greek writer Nikos Kazantzakis, who wrote Zorba the Greek and The Last Temptation of Christ and the sequel to the modern sequel to the Odyssey, he called that activity the Cretan glance, because he traced it back to ancient Crete, traced it back to Daedalus, the Cretan glance. The ability to instantaneously see the truth of a composition and that it can be done, or that it can't be done. That this media, this example of this media, can carry the manifestation the artist wishes to put on it. And of course, the more difficult the media, the greater the artist has to be to work with it. Well, the marble at Carrara lends itself to being a difficult manifestation, but at the same time of being a real strong holder of the form of the artistic creative insight. And so there's Moore and Carrara sizing up. Now the next stage is literally the laying on of the hands. Now this is graphic. Usually it doesn't happen in this way, but it'll happen in a way that, like a sculptor will feel his material. Or an artist will work with his palette. It's literally that old religious laying on of hands. One is blessing, in a way. One is giving of oneself to that material. And notice now that the material is no longer in nature. The material has been taken out from nature and put into another realm. What is that realm? That realm is the realm of psychic energy, the realm of magic. That artistic material, that marble, is no longer in nature, but exists now in a magical realm of psychic energy. Henry Moore's psychic energy. That marble is now going to work with Henry Moore. However Henry Moore moves, that marble will move with him. Now, it may be that a sculptor does not have the facility to move very well. Well, the marble won't move very well. But if you can, the marble will move with you. However the artist moves now, the material is affine to him and no longer exists as a rock strata in a mountain, but it exists in reality in the psychic strata of the artist. So we have a tremendous transformation. This is what came out of that particular block of marble, this sculptural form. If I recall, this particular photograph was taken in Florence. Towards the end of his life, Henry Moore did a great exhibit in Florence, in Italy. And they cleared out a large terrace, huge patio terrace, about 2 or 3 kilometers from the Duomo downtown. And they set Henry Moore's great, massive, late 20th century sculptures up to see how they would look in terms of the Florentine skyline, which is unchanged from the Renaissance. And his works resonated with such power that they were just like Giotto's building, they were just like Bramante's dome. They were legitimate works of art. The whole valley resonated with the presence of those works. And one could see that Moore is a very, very great artist to be able to do this. Just a few of his sculptures now to get a sense, because you're all working with sculpture. You're all making a sculpture. This is one of his early sculptures, a string figure. He liked at this particular time to work with polished woods and thin wire. I think they're almost like piano wire. Now that form, that sculpture, as we see it here, this is an image of that sculpture. In other words, this particular slide, this particular image has reduced the creativity down to an image. The image is not the work. Or as the famous semanticist Korzybski used to say, the map is not the territory. One has to remind oneself, one has to remember. Notice the technique is unmistakable now. One has to remember that this image is not the work. The question now, how many images are there in a work of art? And the answer is an infinite number. It's like a way of just graphically displaying for yourself that a work of art exists in a different realm than imagery. It's not a product, it's not a sum of all the images that one could come up with. If you're trying from that angle to produce a work of art, you never will. You never will. And one of the great moments in an artist's life is the first time that one transcends imagery and works with yourself. And an artist who's really at work, their presence is at play. They're not juggling images, but their presence is at play. Their very presence, their very personal presence is at play. So that there is this kind of a quality. Let's look at two other images of the same sculpture. All right, now this image is quite different from the previous one. If you remember the previous one, there is somewhat of a relation. We realize that we've moved in, but we have a whole different aspect. The volumes, the energies, the spatial relations are all changed. It's still the same work. It's just a different image of that work. Here's a third image. And so you can see with just these three images how protean a work of art is. Here's an image. This is a head. And we might say to ourselves, well, from this vantage point, it has a certain interest, not too much though. Or we can make something out of the abstractness of it. If we see another image of that work, we begin to see that there is a tremendous complication going through the work. One of the techniques is to be able to take the images of a work of art and develop thematic structures, or if you will, to develop motifs of appreciation, thematic structures or motifs of appreciation. You can use either phrase. And the work of art, if it is a work of art, if it is a creative composition expressed from a deep self, it will work with your development of the imagery to the point of transformation, to where you have now given up your sense of working with just images of it to let the work speak to you. If the work is accurate, if you're affine to the work will now restructure the way in which you experience it. And if it has that transformation of the presence of the artist, you will be able to experience that. And there'll be a distinct tone then. It's like if you experience really a musical presentation of the Moonlight Sonata, you will feel Beethoven's personality. So much so that if you then experience the Pastoral Symphony, the Sixth Symphony, or the Overture to the Lenore, whatever other Beethoven piece, you will experience the personality of the artist. It will be there. Where? In you. It will register in you, in your center, in your depth. In this way, art confirms our humanity in the most primordial way possible. It's like a proof and a test that you have arrived as a human being. You're no longer living just on a ritual comportment, but now you're able to thrive on an artistic level, which is different. This is Boer as a fairly young sculptor. He was a teacher. I forget the name of the city, a technical school in some place like Sheffield, England. And he was concerned at that time with protection. He felt threat in the air, and he tried to express it, that somehow what is really us has to be hidden within and protected within, so that there be hard forms outside and very delicate forms inside. And he was obsessed with that. And notice now that it isn't just an image, but it's an idea. It isn't just the image of something delicate within something hard, like a crustacean, but it's the idea of protection. So Moore, working with the symbolic idea, uses that symbolic idea to transform the image base, which he's going to be working with, into a creative, imaginative experience. Later on, this is from the late 1940s. This is Moore's Madonna. You can see the delicate form being protected by the outer form, but now in a much more mature form. He's much farther away from just the images of delicate within and strength without. Now he's worked the idea into an expression where it becomes almost like an ideal. as a very far cry, this sculpture, even though it has a similar theme to the one before, there's 25 years of artistic experience between them. Now let's follow this theme for just a little bit more. This comes about 6 years after that. You can see that Moore has moved away from the Madonna seeming theme. It seemed like it was the Madonna theme that he was working with, the Madonna ideal. But he's developed it even further, and he's showing that every mother and every child is exactly the ideal. That it doesn't have to have a mythic medium to the referent of the natural experience. Any mother with any child together is exactly that protective form with the delicate form, but the delicate form is able to grow into its own protective form. So that there is a theme of deep humanity. This was made in 1953. Moore was doing some work for the United Nations, and I think I might have a slide of the sculpture that he did in front of the UN building in Paris. But at that time, he was concerned with what is the ultimate value that mankind works with to exist. And for him, the ultimate value was that we are able to bring the young into capacity to have their own young. It's the most primordial of all the human values, that we live in such a way that we are able to bring our young into a capacity for them themselves to have young and care for them. That without that link of passing on, no matter what values we developed, they would come to a dead end with our deaths. So that basic link is the basic aspect of humanity, that we are able to pass on to others so that they may pass on to others in return. And so Moore expressed it in this beautiful sculpture. Now, if one is not working with that idea and amplifying it to that ideal and understanding the creative aspect, this work is interesting on one level. But with all the rest of it in play, it becomes a very protean work of art. And indeed, for the mid-20th century, one of the greatest expressions of our confidence in humanity. You have to understand that the 1953, the Cold War, if you don't remember, was particularly voracious. The Korean War was going on, and it was a flip of the coin whether there was going to be nuclear war. Here's a detail from that. Now notice that before, several slides before, the protective shell was all around the delicate little vehicle. Notice the transformation that's happened. The protective shell now is just the hand, the single hand of the mother on the shoulder, the clavicle of the child. And the child is certainly not some kind of haunted, spidery, delicate vehicle, but in its own right is a viable human being. Small yet, nascent, but definitely all there, all together. So you can see the quality that Moore is working for. But Moore is a very great artist. He's working on a level in the 20th century where one is not just expressing the move from the image to the idea to the ideal, but he's living in the 20th century where we have made a quantum jump, as it were, in creative expressiveness. We've moved to abstract art. It's the difference from trying to work with arithmetic to jumping to mathematics. The arithmetical processes can just go so far. But when you jump to mathematics, you jump to an indefinite capacity of application. It's usually called higher mathematics, and there is no end. There is no end to the processes and applications of higher mathematics. Whereas arithmetical procedures, there is a very definite limitation. Arithmetic can be presented, and it never is other than what it is. But But higher mathematics is always protean, and that it, if you were able to follow its whole scope, you would see that it grows constantly. If you go over, for instance, to the bookstore at Caltech and look at the mathematics section and look at the titles, just even the titles of the volumes, you'll see that late 20th century mathematics is going into mystical domains. Every other title, if you took it in a metaphorical sense, would seem like this is the most fantastic thing possible. So Moore is working with abstract art. The figure that I showed you of the transformation of the idea of the Madonna to the ideal of the mother and child now is going to be presented more characteristically of Moore in an abstract way. And for Moore, the abstract is very interesting. Here is the mother and the child. Now watch what happens. Let's go back. In a way, one can say that this mother and child is an abstract image of the mother and the child. This is a whole different order. This is not just an abstract image. This is an abstract work. What has happened? The child has been transformed into a space. Now Moore, particularly of all the sculptors that have ever lived, worked with space as a reality better than anyone else. In other words, he now is moving into a level which he was a pioneer in. And watch what Moore does with his pioneering now. Remember the slide that I showed you of the head and then the reclining body before? Now it's put into a protective form. You've come a long way on abstraction. Now watch what he does with this. Notice now that Moore has turned inside out the space. Everything that was inside is now spatiality. It still has the value, but its value has been transformed to be expressed in space. Let's follow him. Here's the other side of that. Here's the shell taken away, and the shell expressed as space. And because the shell is space, it can penetrate the form wherever it will and carry space with it. So one says, well, this is an abstract form, but you have to be conscious and remember, this is several levels of sophistication. It's not just simply an abstraction. It's not an arithmetical abstraction at all. This involves a transformation. And one has to use creative insight to be able to even see this, much less appreciate it. So that the artist is educating a whole world, saying, can you see this? Like a very great magician. Can you see this? Is there some way that you can comport yourself and transform yourself, sensitize yourself to see what this is? But he carries it even further. This is the beginning of a new phase. Now, the classic influence on Moore at this point was from South America. He saw in an exhibit a rain god figure, Chacmool. I believe from the Chacmool is from the Mayans. And he saw this in an exhibit someplace in Europe. I forget just where it was. And when he saw the figure of the Chacmool, one of the things about the Chacmool figure was that in the stomach area, there was a depression, and it was there in that area that a little bit of rain collected. And he understood that here in the Mayan sculpture,